Wake up, America!
Wake up, America. It's time for Michael Dean After Dark. I'm your host, Michael Dean, Freedom Fiend, and this is the Late Night Feisty Liberty Show. We have a rotating stable of interesting insomniac co-hosts. Plus, we leave the phone lines open. So if the hamster in your brain is keeping you up, please call in. Please call in, or don't. We don't want to talk to humans.
But Homo sapiens need not apply.
There's a human I like talking to here, and his name is Davi Barker, and he's known for a lot of things. Hoodie the homeless, castrate the homeless, eliminate the homeless. No, I'm kidding.
No, I think you've got that one wrong.
I've got you confused with someone else. What's your what are your nonprofit organizations called?
Well, we're not actually a nonprofit organization, according to the IRS. We are a Bitcoin organization, which means we don't touch dollars so that we don't have to fill out those forms. But we are a charity, and we're called Bitcoin Not Bombs. And the campaign we've got going on is called Hoodie the Homeless, which means if you buy a Bitcoin Not Bombs t-shirt, then that pays for one hoodie for one homeless person. And nice. Last year we gave out 325, and this year we've got volunteers in five other cities who've said they'll help us distribute. So we're hoping to 5X that number.
Ah, what does 5X mean?
That means 5 times 300.
I don't know what that is. Explain.
It's math, Mike.
Did you call me Mike?
Michael, sorry.
You called me Mike, didn't you?
Oh. Is that not allowed? Okay.
It's not my name.
No, it's 5X, like multiplied
by
5.
You want it 5 times as much, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's the goal. I don't know if we'll do it, but we're ambitious.
And tell me, what is this Bitcoin of which you speak?
Bitcoin is what they fear it is. Bitcoin is an online digital currency that is distributed, kind of like file sharing. It lets you email money around the internet and doesn't take any bank account and doesn't take any government form.
Huh. Well, that sounds like an interesting thing. Where can I get some of this Bitcoin?
I would go to cashintocoins.com, which is sort of a neat site. It lets you deposit cash into a bank account. They'll give you the bank account number. So, like, I think you have to do a wire transfer now, but essentially you wire money to this company and they'll send Bitcoin to whatever account you specify.
I don't know what that is. I'm just trying to sound like an old person. I know what Bitcoin is. And
if you want to avoid banks altogether, I recommend localbitcoin.com because it's like a Craigslist for Bitcoin.
So you meet in a dark alley. You meet people in a dark alley.
Yeah.
I went on a Bitcoin shopping spree last night. I went to this website called, what was it called? It's called Gift, GYFT.com. Do you know that site?
Yeah, that's a good site.
Yeah, you can get gift cards for like 150 different retailers, including, and this is not an ad. I actually called them up and said, hey, you want to buy some radio ads? And like, we don't do radio ads. Like, you know, I mean, their response, I mean, the guy on the phone was, like, he was polite, but it sounded like I called up, you know, someone in 1940 and said, we are a horse and buggy manufacturer. Would you like to advertise it on the side of your cars? You know, he was just like, radio, come on, man. That's we're building the flying car and you're trying to sell us the Flintstones chariot. I'm like, no, man, radio's good. And there's people who listen to the Bitcoins on radio.
Yeah, it's where you're going to get all the people who cash out their 401ks or their social security checks and buy Bitcoin.
I hear sirens in the background. Is that you? Are they coming to get you?
I don't think so. I don't hear anything.
Coming to get me. Yeah, we cashed out about $2,000 worth of Bitcoin last night. I cashed out all my Namecoin into Bitcoin, and then we bought cards on this, and we went on a shopping spree. We've never gone on a shopping spree. And it's like, I feel weird talking about this on the radio for a couple reasons. One, it's like, you know, some government agency is going to come beat me up for spending money and engaging in free commerce. And the other is like, you know, I pretty much plead poverty all the time. Like, hey, man, help me out. Help out my show. And it's like, basically, I've saved this over the last 3 years, and we just really wanted to do something nice for ourselves, so we did it. And we bought a lot of stuff we needed, you know, like household goods and toiletries and some new clothes. And I spend about $50 a year on clothes, if that. So I bought some clothes you know, for traveling, bought a suitcase for going to Porkfest, couple suitcases, things like that.
That's cool. So you're getting ready for Porkfest, I assume?
Yeah, I'm going to be there. I also bought some buttons, some more Freedom Fiends buttons in Bitcoin.
Yeah, that's cool. You get them from Krizzle's buttons, right?
Yeah, do you? Oh, you don't do buttons, or do you?
I don't do buttons occasionally. I'll do like a freebie. Like I'll put them in all my mailers. I'll do a promotional button, and I'll get those from Krizzle. And then whenever anybody does custom buttons, I always offer them Krizzle's buttons and push the business to him.
Yeah, yeah. Krizzle takes Bitcoin, too. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, Krizzle is... he's a slow talker on the phone, but he's a fast worker getting stuff done.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen him turn around a couple hundred buttons in like 48 hours.
Yep. It's a good thing. It's a beautiful thing.
And I don't know his real name. I like that about him.
I know his real name. Because I've PayPal'd him.
He's part of an elite club.
Yeah.
What's that?
I've PayPal'd him, so I know his real name. But
yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about some other Bitcoin related things, because we're on radio and people on radio are probably going, what? What is that? I want to hear about what Obama's done to me today. We're past that, man. The state is going to state. They're going to do what they're going to do. And
we're building the decentral bank.
Yeah, man. We're going beyond that. You know, tomorrow, Cody Wilson's dark wallet comes out in alpha.
Yeah. I'm excited about that.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I'm trying to get him to do an interview on the Fiends this Saturday.
And people keep talking about something called dark market. I haven't had a chance to figure out what that is exactly, but it has something to do with the dark wallet.
I think it's the new Silk Road.
The new Silk Road.
Maybe it's a dark. Maybe it's a dark wallet specific Silk Road type marketplace, eBay of everything.
It's a good name, that's for sure.
Yeah, and you know it's. That kind of sales behind, you know, outside of the purview of the mean people that are control freaks and want to shut you down. I mean, it's not all about AK-47s and crystal meth. You know, people sell like asthma inhalers that have been outlawed in America for no good reason that are still really useful, you know, because they're basically what happened is, you know, those Primatene Mist asthma inhalers, and I have asthma, really mild, and I only need one of those like once a year or something. But, you know, it was pretty bad until I became an adult, and that happens a lot. You have really bad allergies and asthma until puberty's over, and then it kind of goes away. Mm. But, you know, once a year or so, like one puff on one of those things, and I'm right as rain. Whereas, it's hard to breathe. And
cool.
And not being able to breathe is a really horrible thing. Now, what they've done, basically what happened was Big Pharma got together and pushed through their lobbyists for legislation to outlaw those because they said they were bad for the environment. It's so ridiculous. Like, can you imagine how many of those you'd have to spray to equal, like, 2 minutes of driving a bus or something? But
wait, they're saying that like the aerosol in the inhaler is like what it depletes the ozone layer or something?
Exactly. Because it's actually fluorocarbons. It's like the only thing that was still licensed for using fluorocarbons, which were outlawed in, I think, the 70s or 80s.
So what you're saying is some people need to choke to death so that the rest of us can have clean air.
Yeah. And it's such a... It's such a negligible amount. I mean, if you just sit and watch like a police car idling while they're in getting donuts, you know, that probably destroys the environment while they're in there getting donuts more than like every grandmother in America saving her breathing by you taking a puff on one of these inhalers. But they've outlawed them in America, but they still have them in other countries and people actually sell them. You know, that was one of the things they sold on Silk Road.
I remember reading somewhere that the propulsion system on intercontinental ballistic missiles was deemed by the EPA to be an environmental hazard because it used freon or like emitted freon. And so they made the military change the propulsion system on their missiles because it was bad for the environment.
Yeah, the U.S. government actually stopped using lead bullets to a large extent, and they're now using steel core bullets. And Nima brought that up, and we had an episode about it one time called Killing Brown People Goes Green.
Well, I'm sure they're very appreciative that – no, I don't know what to do with that. Sorry. That's just so ridiculous.
But they still use depleted uranium rounds, which are far more hazardous than lead. You know, the thing about depleted uranium, it's not really – that much of a radioactive health concern. It's what a lot of people don't realize is uranium is a heavy metal like lead, but it's much more toxic. So even depleted uranium that's not that's negligibly radioactive, I mean, it's not causing birth. It causes birth defects, and it's not because of the radioactivity. It's because there's millions of these bullets lying around in the Middle East, and they seep into the water table. And
so it's
just
having a heavy metal in your water. Is that what it is?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like having mercury in the water.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah.
It's a salt the earth policy. I mean, that's what that sounds like to me.
Yeah, salt the earth was a policy. Was that in the Middle Ages or before, or like in the time of Christ or before? Of like,
I don't know. I think it's Middle Ages. It is in the era of like civilization type video games. That's all I know. But what it means is they would literally salt the earth because that meant that your opponent could then not farm on that land if they ever retook it or something.
Yeah. And I'm surprised that that was actually a way of doing things, because I think salt was pretty expensive back then. But if it was near the sea, you could just bring it in, you know, pipe it in water from the sea. But I mean, that's kind of this. It's also called the scorched earth policy. I mean, that's what, you know, at the end in
governments waste valuable resources. Never.
Yeah. Well, governments always now when they leave a region, like blow up all their equipment. Because they don't want even like non-weapons, like communication systems, or, you know, even things like generators, because they don't want to leave. It's cheaper. It's easier than bringing it back home, and they don't want to leave it because somebody might use it for making their life better, let alone.
And if they don't spend that money, they don't get it in their budget next year.
So they have to.
That's probably part of it.
They have to wipe the slate clean on the account by blowing all their stuff up when they leave.
I remember hearing about the Navy doing that they destroyed old equipment so that they could get new equipment because it was the only way to do it.
Man, wouldn't it be nice if that's how it worked? Like, if you just went, my TV's really old, it took a sledgehammer to it, and then some guy showed up at your house a couple hours later with a new one.
That does sound great.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk about a new cryptocurrency system that may do that with Namecoin when we get back. Worms.
This radio show is called Michael Dean After Dark. Go to michaelwdean.com to help keep it drone-proof.
The Michigan Peace and Liberty Coalition is proud to announce the second annual Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest. It's at the Circle Pine Center just outside Kalamazoo, Friday, August 22nd through Monday, August 25th. There will be family and grown-up friendly activities, great conversation, presentations, and bacon. Lots of bacon. It doesn't matter if you're an OG libertarian, a newbie, or just anarcho-curious. Come on out and enjoy some voluntarism. For more information, go to miplc.org.
This is Michael Dean, Michael Dean After Dark. Talking to Davy Barker, who's also known for having gotten felt up by the TSA because they were looking for his Bitcoin, right?
Yeah, they saw it in my bag and they wanted to count it to make sure that I wasn't trafficking an illegal amount of money across an international border.
Yeah, they don't even know what that is, man. They saw some buttons, basically.
They saw a bunch of lapel pins.
Yeah, and you know. And, yeah, they'd seen some PowerPoint presentation warning them about Bitcoin, and they grabbed the first image off Google Images probably that said Bitcoin, and they used that one that all the newspapers use because they need an image, and there's really no picture of Bitcoin, so they use this physical.
Well, they're like toddlers. They can't read things without pictures.
Well, you know, they say that the Iraq war was sold with a PowerPoint presentation at the highest levels. You know about that?
No, what do you mean?
I mean, they got a bunch of generals in a room and Dick Cheney and crew, you know, they put Bush over in the corner and gave him a warm, hot chocolate to keep him occupied and gave him his binky and then said, we need to go to war because they have weapons of mass destruction. And they used a PowerPoint presentation to sell it to the generals and the decision makers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. C-spot, bomb Iraq.
Yeah, yeah, something like
run,
that.
Run, spot, bomb Iraq.
Yeah. Okay, so this article in Motherboard Vice Magazine, the Motherboard part. Are you on the part where it says, government, a conspiracy theorist's wet dream?
I am.
Okay, so basically this is the, you know, the perfunctory, everyone has to have one of these articles. Who is Satoshi Nakamoto, creator of Bitcoin? Because if you don't know, he's pretty anonymous. He worked with other people over the internet, and he wrote the source code, and he wrote the protocol, and worked with one or two other people at first, and then disappeared and left it in charge of those one or two people about 5 years ago. And there's been a lot of conjecture of who is Satoshi Nakamoto. It's kind of like, you know, who killed Mr. Burns or some, you know, some big soap
opera. It is a lot like who killed Mr. Burns.
Didn't Maggie the baby actually shoot Mr.
Maggie
Burns?
Maggie the baby killed Mr. Spoiler alert.
Shot Mr. Burns. Yeah. Spoiler alert. A 15-year-old Simpsons. Yeah. So, you know, they go through all these people who are different programmers and cryptography experts and, you know, the possibility that it's more than one person. And then they get down to the possibility that it is a government. Now, will you read this part? I'd like to discuss this.
You want me to just read it?
Yeah.
A conspiracy theorist's wet dream. Another idea that gets tossed around is that Bitcoin is the product of some government or governmental agency. From that vantage point, resources are no longer an issue. But why? The answer is more of an intellectual exercise than an actual theory. Bitcoin could be used as a weapon against the U.S. dollar. It could be used to fund black ops. We've been saying this for a while. The CIA needs to adopt Bitcoin so they stop getting caught trafficking drugs.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you think about it, it's often called a Ponzi scheme, and it's really not, because a Ponzi scheme, the original –
there's no Ponzi and no scheme. That's
the original investors in a Ponzi scheme make lots of money, and everybody makes money. Actually, technically, if a Ponzi scheme was never shut down by a government and went to infinity, it would continue to make money for everybody. But it's not a Ponzi scheme, because while the original investors are well rewarded for getting in early if they keep their coin for a while, it's, you know, the people at the tail, like now, who didn't get in early and make a lot of money on it, still get to use it. You know, it builds a network. So it's not a Ponzi scheme. But it is possible, you know, that if the CIA did it, that they did it to fund their black ops, because, you know, there are millions or millions of dollars in Bitcoin that are either unspent or not known, you know, what happened to them from the original Genesis block and the blocks right after that.
I mean, I suppose it is kind of a level of genius I don't expect from government very often. But maybe they just gave a grant to some genius and he sat in a classified basement for 10 years and came up with it or something.
I would imagine that governments probably have, you know what the genius grant is, right? It's a non-governmental thing, I think, but it's like a grant that's given to somebody for doing something really cool and smart with no strings attached. Like basically just do this and then keep doing your thing. There may be genius grants within Black Ops of America or other governments where they're like, they take the best and brightest or just arrest people for, you know, snooping in government computers and threaten to put them in jail for 100 years and say, you can do this instead. And it'll be like a video game where they just say, do what you want and give us the result. You know, just let them, you know, 100 brilliant monkeys typing, basically. Maybe that came up with Bitcoin. We'll be back. We'll be back with more.
You are destined to be listening to this show, Michael Dean After Dark, on this very night. Thank you for arriving.
Shiny badges on your jacket. Shiny badges start a conversation with your neighbor or your doctor or your family or your school. Now there's teachers and lawyers and business executives, and they all wear shiny badges and they all reject the state. Shiny badges on your jacket. Shiny badges show the world that you reject coercion and aggression and oppression by the state. Shinybadges.com.
Yeah. It's Michael Dean. Freedom theme. I've been looking at this BitShares thing. You looked at that there, Dobby?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's another one of those do everything on the blockchain things. I'm kind of intrigued by it. I'm looking at it. I haven't made a decision yet, but I'm trying to figure it out.
I'm waiting for people smarter than me to advise me to use it.
I might be smarter than you.
It's possible. You did advise me to get into Namecoin.
Yeah, but what if I advise you to get out of it and get into something else?
I don't know. If there's one thing I've learned about you and financial decisions, it's that you're all in or all out.
Huh. Explain that. Talk about that more.
Well, I mean, like when you got into Namecoin, you were scrambling. You're like, I will give you anything for Bitcoin to buy Namecoin.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I think I offered to make you feel real good for some Bitcoin.
Over the internet, in fact.
Yeah. Oh, wait. I think we got Nick calling in here. Someone named Nick. Yeah. Are you there, Nick?
I am here.
Are you still there, Davi? What's on your mind, Nick?
Oh, I wanted to ask Davi some questions about that study he was doing, or I heard about him doing.
Yeah?
Huh. It was, I can't remember exactly, but something about somebody coming in through the hall, seeing a security cam, and watching somebody get attacked by either a police officer or somebody random, and how they responded to that. I was wondering how that was going.
Are you there, Davi?
I'm here. What's going on?
Nick has a question for you. Can you say the question again there, Nick?
Yeah, so I heard about your study that you're doing on the, it seemed like an abuse of authority, because you had somebody coming through a hallway that was empty, and then later seeing that hallway in the security camera.
Right, yeah.
So I was interested about that.
You want me to summarize it for you?
Yeah.
So yeah, essentially, subjects are led to believe that they're there to watch an unreleased movie trailer, and then they're put in a room where they're told to wait, and there's surveillance footage of the hallway they just came from. And at some point, on that surveillance footage is a pre-recorded incident of unprovoked assault, and half of the subjects will see a police officer, and half of the subjects will see a civilian assault. And so the question is, will they go into the hallway to intervene? If they go into the hallway, there's nothing there, but they're led to believe that the surveillance footage is in the room right next to them.
So you did this? You took part in this?
No, we're fundraising for this now. I pitched this at Porkfest and took first place in the Agorist pitch, which earned me a shiny ounce of gold.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
What if the person is a concealed carry holder, weapon, and they decide to intervene and they go out guns drawn? Are there actually people out in the hallway or not?
No, there is no one out in the hall, and that is one of the reasons why there is no one out in the hall. It is designed so that they're rushing into a conflict scenario where there's absolutely nothing they can threaten. Although we'll probably end up doing it in California the first time, so I'm not terribly worried about concealed carry, but that is a concern that people have brought up. But yeah, so essentially, I've been going around to events. I've been pitching the idea. I got a lot of people interested in it. We've got a book coming out by Porkfest that is about all of the previous research on authority and obedience, sort of summed up and described in the sort of terms that I think lead into this experiment and why this experiment is sort of the natural evolution of that research if you ignore the APA.
What's the APA?
The American Psychological Association. They write the ethical guidelines for psychological research, and it's sort of their fault that things like the Stanford Prison Experiment were never repeated, and it's their fault that most of the research on authority since Milgram are boring. I'm suggesting that if we are going to impact the culture, then we need to do an experiment that's dramatic. And so this one is designed to sort of be a little more dramatic than some of the more boring and university stuff that's been done.
You know, the Milgram experiment, it's hard to find footage of that. There's actual film of it, and there's a company that sells DVDs of it, and they sell the DVDs for like $150 each to schools only. Well, I guess they would sell them to private citizens, but yeah. So that's another reason. I don't even know if it's on YouTube. Have you ever looked?
I don't recall ever seeing actual footage of it. I was more interested in the statistics, though. I was looking at data charts and things like that.
Explain what the Milgram experiment is and the Stanford Prison Experiment. A lot of people haven't heard of them, and you believe they should, and I believe they should, too.
Oh, yeah. Everybody should be aware of these. And the fact that these occurred in the 70s and nothing meaningful has been done in this realm since then is depressing to me. But essentially, the Milgram experiment was designed after World War II to sort of see whether or not Americans would follow the orders the Nazis did. And essentially, the subject is led to believe that there's a person hooked up to these electrodes and they're told that you're to ask these people these questions.
You're burying the lead. The lead is it was an experiment to see if Americans would act like the Nazis and just follow orders and torture people. And the answer is yes, they will.
Yes, they will. That's the answer was 65% of Americans were willing to electrocute a complete stranger to death because someone in a lab coat told them to.
Yeah, that's horrible.
That's the lead.
That is horrible. Yeah, so go on.
The Stanford Prison Experiment is also a study of authority, and it's, I think, 24 Stanford University students sort of put on a mock prison, and they were supposed to do it for 2 weeks, where half of them were prisoners and half of them were guards, and they were to keep a regular schedule. And they had to halt it after 6 days because the guards were torturing the prisoners. They were forcing them to walk around naked, forcing them to wallow in their own feces, locking them in solitary confinement, depriving them of bedding, depriving them of food.
Did you know that Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, took part in some studies like that at Harvard?
I believe it was
Harvard, whatever Ivy League university he went to. Yeah, he took part in some things like that and was really horrified by it and was changed for life. And that may have led, you know, I mean, you can't excuse what he did, but it may have led to him acting on that instead of just writing about it.
That's a really interesting piece of information.
I'll look that up. Continue in your conversation, but I'll get some confirmation on that here from the interwebs.
Yeah, so this professor, Philip Zimbardo, who ran the prison experiment, said that he was taken in to his role as superintendent, and he had allowed torture to go on far beyond what he should have as a professor. And so he wrote this book called The Lucifer Effect, How Good Men Turn Evil. And it's about how systemic forces around you can incentivize evil, and how he thinks that the U.S. military intentionally designed Abu Ghraib and other military prisons to create torture without ordering it so that they would have plausible deniability.
So while at Harvard, Kaczynski was among 22 Harvard undergraduates used as guinea pigs in ethically questionable experiments conducted by Henry Murray. In the experiment, each student received a code name. Kaczynski was given the code name Lawful. Among other purposes, Murray's experiments were focused on measuring people's reactions under extreme stress. The unwitting undergraduates were submitted to what Murray himself called vehement, sweeping, and personally abusive attacks. Assaults to their egos, cherished ideals, and beliefs were the tools used to cause high levels of stress and distress. These experiments were conducted at Harvard from the fall of 1959 through the spring of 1962 and were part of the CIA-sponsored MK-Ultra experiments. MK-Ultra is best known for one small part of it, which was giving LSD to unknowing U.S. soldiers and a few scientists. And one of the scientists jumped out of the window because he thought he was going crazy because he didn't, you know. I mean, LSD is a very powerful drug, but taking it without knowing you're taking it would probably lead you to think you're going crazy.
Oh, yeah. Unless you've done it before. And then I think you'd be sort of inoculated against somebody manipulating you with it.
Yeah.
But yeah, totally insane. You know, that sounds like Abu Ghraib, too. The idea of using people's ideologies against them as a form of torture. Like a lot of the things that were used as torture in these prisons are not things that we would generally think of as torture ourselves, but they were to those people because they were designed for them. And it was things like exposing them to like dogs or like exposing them to like strippers and
throwing their Quran in the toilet or throwing a Quran in the toilet. Yeah.
Yeah. Things like that would be meaningful to them, but they don't sound like that to us. There was one incident of a guy who was naked, who was thrown into like a satanic altar or something like that.
Wow.
And it was totally just to get under his skin and into his head, you know?
Yeah, I think they probably do a lot of experiments like this, you know, the genius grants for the sick geniuses to see what they can come up with. And they probably have determined at some point that pulling out someone's fingernails or waterboarding them, first of all, you know, it looks bad in the news if it gets out, but secondly, it's probably not as effective as things that, you know, don't leave physical marks but are more psychologically scarring.
No, it's not. It's been shown to be ineffective because what ends up happening is the person tells you whatever they think you want them to say. They don't tell you the truth.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so you end up getting a lot of bad intelligence by torturing people.
Yeah.
If you, there's a really interesting interview that I've heard, and there's a number of them, of the guy who was in charge of interrogating Saddam Hussein when he was in custody. And he said his entire strategy was about getting to know the man and befriending the man, because he was so egotistical that the strategy was you just need to appeal to his pride, make him want to say the things that he's proud of having done. And that worked.
Yeah, and I think that with, you know, when you're dealing with some kind of evil genius that you're trying to get information out of, you'd have to be pretty slick about it. You know, I watch cop movies like where they have an average criminal in there and they're like, you know, interrogating with like, man, we've got a lot of people in here and criminals in here. They've never done anything as brilliant as what you did, when it's like obvious the cops appealing to their ego. And
it might just be bad acting.
It could be too, and it could be bad writing. But I've thought about those scenarios because of TV shows, and I'm like, man, first of all, I have no useful information for any law enforcement, because I basically bug my own house with radio. I say everything I believe comes out of my mouth on government-controlled radio. But secondly, if some cop tried to appeal to me with that, it would be so transparent.
Well, I have no illusions that the cops are my friends. So, like, yeah. I can't imagine things like that. Like, we're just trying to make this easy on you. Like, I can't imagine believing any of that.
Yeah, although it might be easier to believe that somebody at some high-level agency, like some black op thing beyond the CIA, that there'd be somebody in it who really hates their job. Like, you know, I mean, they might try to appeal to somebody like, you know, for me, they might have a better chance if they sent, like, the guy who claimed to be the next Edward Snowden, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, a cop would just turn me off. There's no way I'm going to believe that they're my friend. But, and I'm not saying that would work, but you know, that would be smarter than just trying to have a cop be my friend or be someone's friend, you know?
Well, I wonder if they just use the same tactic over and over and over and over again, because I imagine that the suspects don't sort of get out of jail and get out of prison and suddenly say, hey, guess what happened to me, and then tell all of his friends. Like, I'll bet there's a lot of repeatability.
That's one reason they don't let him out when they're supposed to let him out, I think, even when they determine they're not a threat. All right. We'll be back. Stay around, Nick.
When you shop online, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you any extra, and the fiends will get a little taste from Amazon, and Amazon will save you the danger of drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon sells pretty much everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. But they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. So get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com. Freedom, Foxtrot, Echo, Echo, November, Sierra.com.
Yeah. Hold your Bitcoin tight. It's a cold night in Wyoming. Hold it tight, warm it up and love it, and then spend it. Because that's what it's for. It's for spending. Dobby, you spend Bitcoin, don't you?
I do spend Bitcoin.
Does it keep MK Ultra away from your brain?
I don't think I would know. Okay. Isn't the idea there that you're like a double agent or something?
Nah, MK Ultra is more about, it was about psychological methods of mind control.
I thought it was about trying to make a Manchurian candidate. Isn't that the idea?
That was one of the possible things. Through,
I mean, if I were a Manchurian candidate, I wouldn't be able to tell you.
Well, it was organized through the Scientific Intelligence Division of the CIA, and the project was coordinated with the Special Operations Division of the U.S. Army's Chemical Corps, which is the part tasked with defending against chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear weapons. Although, you know, counter snipers are also snipers, depending on which side of a fence you're looking at. So
yeah, kind of like counter terrorists are also terrorists.
The program engaged in many illegal activities. In particular, it used U.S. and Canadian citizens as test subjects, including the surreptitious administration of drugs, especially LSD and other chemicals, hypnosis, sensory deprivation, isolation, verbal and sexual abuse, as well as other forms of torture. How do you spell Abu Ghraib? I want to search and see if that's on this page.
It's ABU space GRAIBE.
It's not in this article, but sounds to me like that you're right. That came out of this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, Nick, You got questions?
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit more about your experiment.
Yeah, shoot.
What is your hypothesis? Do you think people are going to defend?
Do you think people are basically good or evil?
So I have three hypotheses that are outlined in the design of the experiment. One is I believe that a high percentage of people will not intervene, and I think it'll be similar to the Milgram experiment, somewhere around 65%.
Now, see, I don't know if I'd intervene if I saw on a camera that someone in the next room was being beaten. That's a lot different than would I shock and torture people. No, I wouldn't. But intervening is basically playing cop. And you never know what's going on from looking at it, you know?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that sort of rationalizations will be teased out in an exit interview, and that'll be part of the analysis, right?
You know, I mean, if I looked at, you know, it could be an off-duty cop beating up another cop for sleeping with his wife or something. And if I went out and did anything about it, I could end up getting shot and arrested. That would cross my mind.
Yeah, I guess that's what you want to know, though. You want to know how much police brutality will people witness before they intervene, and if it's none.
So wait, is it going to be people dressed as cops doing the beating?
Yes, half the subjects are going to.
I didn't catch that part.
Yeah, that's the point. So, second hypothesis: more people will intervene on an incident between two civilians than will intervene on an incident where a police officer assaults a civilian for no reason.
Are you going to give anybody any preparation in their description or whatever disclaimer they sign to indicate, you know, to keep you from getting sued and to cover yourself morally?
So because the subjects are there believing they're there to watch a movie trailer, within the waiver is, are you willing to watch violent footage? And that's the waiver we're using to show them the surveillance footage.
Okay.
And then the third hypothesis is that demographic information or personality data from the subjects can be used to create a psychological profile of those willing to intervene. And that's really what we're looking for is what, like, if we have all this research about the psychological profile of the person who obeys, we want to begin to amass a psychological profile of the person who does not obey.
Tell me more.
And that's the point. Well, once you have that, you can use it to target your activism, right? Like I have no idea what it would be, but like, let's say, for example, we discovered that there's a high correlation that people who like action movies obey and people who like sci-fi movies disobey.
Ah.
Then that means that you're if you want to do libertarian outreach at a convention, the sci-fi convention is the place to go.
There you
right?
go.
Cool. Like, that's the kind of science I want to be doing.
You're listening to Michael Dean After Dark. Go to michaelwdean.com. That's michaelwdean.com.
Good evening, my fellow
worms.
I know some things I don't know.
I'll be back with more later on.
I'm never satisfied.
This is Michael Dean After Dark.
The stato sperimentato.
The United States government presents
No Vision. Congrats.
Not having enough money.
The power was so great.
To provide guidance to mankind.
Go to michaelwdean.com for more. That's michaelwdean.com. We'll be back for hour two after this trip to the market on Michael Dean After Dark.
Bye for now.
You've read books, attended lectures, and you know the Constitution well enough to know it's a well-crafted blueprint to create an ever-increasing federal empire. But there's still one thing missing.
Buttons!
Freedom Fiends now has buttons. You'll get state speech is hate speech, guns and weed, buy sheep for sheep on sheep, and two designs for the Freedom Fiends. Wear them with pride. Use them to start conversations with statists. It's only $10 for 10 buttons, including shipping. Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says buttons.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
Yep. So Davi, are you there, Davi?
Yes.
So Davi and I, every time we got a show, we exchange a bunch of notes and links, and about 10 articles we're going to discuss, and we usually like start with one of them, just throw it out the window.
Promptly ignore them.
Yeah, yeah. So we're talking about torture and the governments who love it. So carry on, guys.
Governments and the torture, yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Well,
you mean enhanced interrogation.
Yeah, yeah. It's extra special. It's interrogation plus. It's new flavored interrogation.
Right. It's interrogation 2.0. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I feel like government sort of invented torture. I can't think of many private scenarios where torture is useful, except maybe like some sort of mafia scenario.
Or, yeah. Yeah. So,
but I repeat myself.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, where someone... And mafias, as we know them, really can't exist without governments because they generally deal in the illegal of things that shouldn't be illegal. And they provide those things that are illegal at a highly inflated price where they're paying – the price you're paying is more for the risk involved rather than what it's actually worth. Like, for instance, a machine gun, you know, a full auto version of a common rifle costs about 25 cents more to make. But they sell, when you can buy them legally, they sell for like 20, you know, like an AK-47 that's semi-auto, you can buy in America legally for $500. To buy a full auto one legally, there's like a $150 permit you have to get and a background check. And then states where you can own them, it costs you about $25,000 to buy one. And that's even legal, although you could probably buy a full auto converted one that wasn't very safely full auto for a lot less than that much, but more than the, you know, basically like what is an ounce of marijuana cost, you know, compared to what it would cost if it were completely legal and not taxed and there were no black market for it? I mean, it would cost about as much as an ounce of corn, probably.
If it was free and decriminalized and there were no regulations or taxes attached to it at all, it would cost as much as any other household weed. I mean, like you would be pulling the stuff out of the ground to get rid of it.
Yeah,
and I guess people would pay premiums for strains that people had spent time cultivating.
Yeah, but they do with oregano too, or they do with steak. You know?
Oh yeah.
Nima Vidati and I did a Freedom Fiends episode called "And all drugs would cost 9 cents a dose," because I did a bit of fuzzy math and figured out what every drug would cost in libertarian paradise, in LibPair. And I figured out it would be about 9 cents a dose.
Okay. How did you arrive at that math?
I think I did it by going into my kitchen and looking at a spice bottle of a common spice, like oregano, and seeing how much an ounce of it cost. And I think it was like, you know, $4.99 an ounce, and I figured marijuana would probably cost about the same.
And, well, here's the thing. I get this from my dad. When I travel, I bring home spices as gifts and souvenirs for people because the spices you get overseas are different than the spices, even if you're not from your town. If you're buying local spices, they're often different than the ones that you get in the supermarket.
What countries are you bringing spices back from, and how does the TSA deal with you when you do it?
Well, I'm pretty small amount, so I don't think there was ever – I've never been hassled about it at all. But I brought my dad some saffron home from Saudi Arabia when I was there last year.
Saffron's expensive though. Saffron's like drug prices. Isn't it like $500 an ounce or something?
Not in Saudi Arabia.
Well, yeah. How much is a brick of hash in Afghanistan? You know,
I could not answer that one. I spent about – you know, I don't even know what I spent because I was spending rials, and rials are like faker than dollars.
Why?
Like the exchange rate is like 1 to 30, and they have pictures of the king on them.
The king.
So, yeah, I kind of lost track of spending money when I was there. But I think that's by design. I think that's part of governments colluding together to trick tourists into spending their money places is making the conversions difficult.
Is there a lot of – I know that there's a lot of fabulous wealth in Saudi Arabia. Is there a lot of poverty too?
Yes, there is intense poverty. There's like, I don't know if you've seen Slumdog Millionaire, but there is actually an industry of like taking children and amputating things so they're better at begging in Saudi Arabia.
I know that happens in India. Is that in that movie Slumdog Millionaire?
Yeah, I think they used acid to take out some kid's eyes in that movie.
There's a Henry Rollins spoken word rant about that phenomenon well before that movie came out, like 10 years before that, where he talks about going to India and seeing that. And then he's like, And then he comes back to Hollywood where he lives, and he, and some like healthy kid with a leather jacket on a skateboard's like, "Hey man, you got a dollar?" And he's like, "You amateur."
Well, I mean, I saw dozens of those kids, and I wouldn't give them money because my thought was that if I give them money, it's just going to be taken from whoever their handler is.
And you're encouraging them to saw off more limbs.
Right. So I bought them food. I spent a day distributing food.
They probably got beaten for accepting food.
Man,
I'm really kidding. I don't know. I don't know how the amputation industrial complex works in Saudi Arabia. I really don't know. Don't they saw off hands there for stealing?
I've heard they still do that. I think it's still on the books, yeah. Hmm. I'm not sure. You'd have to find a neoconda to give you a YouTube video.
What text is that from? Is that an interpretation of some religious text?
I'm not sure, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. It is absolutely like some sort of medieval law.
I think it's in the Old Testament, isn't it?
Maybe.
Which is, Muslims do read the Old Testament, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And the New Testament, right?
Yeah.
That just blows the minds of Christians, I'm sure, when they hear that.
Maybe that's like buried or something, but yeah, absolutely. Like the Quran presents itself as sort of a continuation of that revelation. So
Nick, we got Nick here too. I forgot about Nick. What's up, Nick?
Nothing much.
What do you want to know?
Quiet. I'll add into that. The way I think of it is the Jews had the Old Testament and the Christians added, the Jews had the Old Testament. Did I say that right?
Yes.
Yeah, the Torah, right?
Yeah, they had the Torah, and then the Christians added the New Testament, and then the Muslims added the Quran. Am I right?
Essentially.
That's the order. Although the Torah is not the same as the Old Testament necessarily, is it?
I thought that it was. Is it not?
I don't know. I don't know what that is. You can hear me typing away on Wikipedia. Yeah.
I should really know that. I mean, I have, like, my brother is Jewish. You'd think I would know that, but.
It has a range of meanings. It can most specifically mean the first five books of the Tanakh, T-A-N-A-K-H. I'm probably saying that wrong. It can mean this plus the rabbinic commentaries on it. It can mean the continued narrative from Genesis to the end of the Tanakh. And it can mean the totality of Jewish teaching and practice. So, yeah, it's kind of like saying democracy. It means different things in different situations to different people.
All the important words are like that. It's really frustrating.
It really is. I mean, take Bitcoin. It can be the whole system. It can be a single unit of it. It can be the software that you mine it and trade it on. Same thing with BitTorrent. BitTorrent is the name of a piece of software. It's the name of the whole network. And it's the name of the protocol. It's confusing, man.
This whole like language thing humans have going really needs some clarification.
Yeah, this planet you guys have here, I'm not sure I'm going to stick around.
I want off this rock.
I want to go to a different rock. Yeah. So, Nick, how's your llamas?
Yaks,
I'm sorry.
That's fine. They're doing great.
I'm probably not the first person to make that mistake, huh?
No. Alpacas. They called that. Yeah. But they're doing great. You know, same as they were.
Tell me more.
Still pregnant.
Still pregnant.
Yeah. The calves should be coming in May or June.
Do they have somewhere to go inside? Like a llama barn? I mean, a yak barn?
No, they don't. They just... sit out there.
And, should you build them something like that for winter? Or?
No, they're used to the Tibetan steppes.
Yeah, they're furry. Yeah, they're kind of furry Tibetan like bison steps. Are.
What does that mean, Tibetan steppes?
It's a type of mountain range, the steppes.
Oh, okay. I'm imagining like temple steppes or something. Like,
now, picture a mountain that's built like temple steppes.
Okay.
Yeah, there's steppes in Russia too. So, did we finish? Where did we land on torture? I guess we're against it. I guess that's our conclusion.
I'm against it. Yeah, that's me.
What do you think about the classic like kindergarten morality experiment of if there's one person who absolutely knows where the bomb is that's going to kill a million people, is it okay to torture him to get the information from him?
I mean, that's a lifeboat scenario, right? Like, that's not how philosophy works. So why would he tell you the truth? Why wouldn't he just tell you what you wanted him to say?
That's true, because somebody who was willing to do that would probably be willing to be tortured and die to be able to still do it.
No, but what I mean is that what they've sort of shown is that the person doesn't tell the truth in that scenario. They tell you whatever they think will get you to stop torturing them.
So you want to be their friend and try to trick it out of them.
Essentially. So, like, let's say, for example, like, you think I know where the bomb is and you're going to torture me over it. I'm going to tell you where the bomb is. It's in Atlanta. And you're going to spend all this time and resources going to Atlanta, and you're going to discover, oh, he just said whatever he could to get me to stop torturing him. Like, it's, you know what I mean? Like,
my problem with those kind of lifeboat scenario thought experiments is that I think the main purpose for them is to stretch them to a slippery slope.
Yeah, that is exactly right.
Because I think most people would say yes to that question, and then the next question is, well, what if you're 80% sure he knows where the bomb's hidden? And then it gets down to, like, well, what if there's a group of 100 people and you're pretty sure maybe possibly one of them knows? Is it okay to torture all of them? And, you know, it just extrapolates out basically until, is it okay for governments to just keep everyone in a cage running on a treadmill?
Well, here's the thing. Reality doesn't work that way. Like, every lifeboat scenario is a contrived scenario that doesn't describe what would happen in reality. Like, how do you know he knows where the bomb is? There must be some degree of evidence or like, that is a nuanced scenario all the way down.
Well, in Hollywood movies, it's pretty clear, and that's where it's most commonly used.
Well, yeah, those are contrived scenarios.
All right, we'll be back with more contrived scenarios on Freedom Fiends After Dark with Michael Dean and Dobby Barker and Nick. Nikki Hayes.
You're listening to Michael Dean After Dark, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
Creamy Radio Audio. Want caviar sound on a cat food budget? Creamy Radio Audio by the Freedom Fiends has great free tips so you can sound like a pro without spending like one. The most powerful form of human communication is one person speaking to another. But if people have to suffer through your sound, they'll change the channel and miss your message. With articles on microphones, preamps, recorders, mastering, recording remotely over the internet, doing a podcast, even getting a show on actual radio, the Freedom Fiends show you what they use and where to get it. Whether you're a talk show host, voiceover artist, podcaster, evangelist, or just want to record your loved ones for the ages, at Creamy Radio Audio, the Freedom Fiends will help you make the most of your sound. Creamy Radio Audio will help you speak to the world with sound that will make people want to keep listening. Check out creamyradioaudio.com. That's creamyradioaudio.com.
Freely talking. It's free talk and it's live, but it's not free talk live. It's Michael Dean After Dark, also known as Freedom Fiends After Dark, for those in on the in-joke, on the in-truth, on the in-story. So, Davi.
Yes.
Yes. We're talking about our friend Ernie Hancock, who's one of the great Liberty Radio people. We like him.
For sure.
That guy gets more yakking done by 9 a.m. than I do all day.
Yeah. He's been doing a morning show like every day for as long as I've been alive.
Yeah. It's really hard for me to be on his show because I have to set an alarm to get up to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Even before I was doing this late night show. But lately I've been getting up even later. I've been going to sleep at like 6 in the morning and getting up at like 1:30 in the afternoon. I like it, except on the weekends when I have to do the Freedom Fiends show and get up at 9:45. It's hard.
Maybe this would be a good adaptation to the summertime in California if I just went nocturnal to keep away from the sun.
Well, it's I kind of am, but it's kind of hard having a spouse who works 9-to-5 and do it.
Yeah.
Although, actually, the real schedule to get – that works even better with a spouse that works 9-to-5 is get up, start going to bed after she goes to work and then sleep all day. You actually will spend more time with her than ever, except probably on the weekends. because then you'll just be sleeping all day going, shh, be quiet, I'm sleeping. It's helpful, though, if you have like a separate space you can sleep in that's kind of soundproof, and I kind of do because I've built a radio studio in a bedroom, and it's I can be pretty I can be isolated in my windowless bunker, as Ian Freeman calls it.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely have like converted a bedroom into an office. I don't know that I've like converted into a studio per se. Like I haven't put up like eggshell foam or anything like that, but maybe one day.
You should. Hey, let's go back to this Vice article about who is Satoshi and is he the government? Who is
Satoshi Nakamoto?
Is he the government? The inventor of Bitcoin? Is he the government?
I still maintain Satoshi Nakamoto is a reptilian alien from Planet X.
Why?
Well, I don't know. If you've come across these, this is like the David Icke conspiracy, right? That alien reptiles from Planet X need our gold, and they genetically engineered human beings to mine for gold so that they didn't need to do it themselves. So here's the thing. If Planet X is coming back, it's just physics. Their signals are going to get here before their ships do. So if they were going to be an invading force in the real world, not in like sci-fi where there's warp drive and stuff, but the invading force from another planet should send an invasive signal before the ships arrive. And I think Bitcoin is that signal. I think it's designed to satisfy all of the human psychological need for gold so that when they get here, we'll willingly give up our gold because we have Bitcoin. Who needs gold anymore?
That's interesting. Interesting theory. I like gold, though. And gold has a lot of use in tech, in industry, though, too.
Yeah, but the reptiles need it to save their environment.
They eat it. They breathe gold.
They breathe gold. It is. It's to save. I think it was their ozone layer or something.
Yeah, too. They need to put it up so they can shield their planet from talk radio waves coming from the Earth that disturb their brains. Except for
I love this theory. It is incredibly ridiculous. But the people who really love it and get a hold of it and believe it, they're comical in their belief in this story.
Is ridiculous, but are you extrapolating on his theory and adding to it, or is it just
no? People still believe this. People are still developing this theory, and people disagree about the role of the aliens and how many aliens there are.
About Bitcoin and gold. For.
Oh no, that's just my.
Oh, that's theory. That's what you've added to it. Yeah,
that's my addition to the opus of reptile alien conspiracy.
Well,
theories.
there is a pretty widespread conspiracy theory that computer technology came out of aliens. You know about that one? Because, you know, supposedly when the aliens landed in Roswell, 1956 was it? Like, that's pretty much around the time computers started really being useful. I mean, only governments had them at the time too. But, you know, the technological jumps from the 50s to now, I mean, it's far more than all of human recorded history together. It's standing on the shoulders of giants too, but it really has made some amazing leaps.
Well, that's the jumping Jesus equation, right? Have you heard of this?
No.
If you take all human data from the first sentient life on Earth to the life of Jesus Christ, and you call that one unit, because units tend to be named after their discoverer. So this is Jesus with a small j, is a unit of information. That information doubles exponentially over time. And you'll see that this sort of like coincides with things like the Renaissance or the American Revolution or things like that. And there's this point at which this equation sort of reaches a tangential curve where it's tripling and doubling so fast that I don't know what happens. Maybe
is that
the singularity
a Robert, or is that a Robert Anton Wilson theory?
Yes, absolutely it is.
Yeah, it sounds like it. The jumping Jesus phenomenon. I want to talk about that when we come back. I like Robert Anton Wilson, man. He's my favorite anarchist. There's a great video of him on YouTube of him talking with Carl Hess for about 3 hours at a libertarian festival. Back in the day.
You are destined to be listening to this show, Michael Dean After Dark, on this very night. Thank you for arriving.
Want to contribute to Liberty but short on cash? You can help the Freedom Fiends without even spending a post-1964 dime. Download uTorrent and start seeding Fiends episodes and DVDs to help keep us drone-proof. There's a Torrent Club link at the top of freedomfiends.com. There you'll find our Torrent RSS feed and instructions to grab past episodes and automatically download new ones, even while you're away from the computer. You'll also get special episodes of The Fiends days or even weeks before regular podcast subscribers who aren't torrenting. Leave your computer on, seeding the torrents while you're at work or asleep. The more people seeding The Fiends, the more drone-proof we'll be when the boot comes down.
Click, click. It's Michael Dean. It's After Dark. We're talking to Davi Barker. Are you there, Davi? Check in, please.
I'm here.
Excellent. Excellent. So we were talking about Robert Anton Wilson, the sci-fi writer and amazing futurist liberty kind of guy. We really dig him. And I was saying, I like his nonfiction, like his articles, better than his fiction, because his fiction is far too clever. Like it just oozes, I am clever and I'm writing something clever. And what did you say about that?
Well, his nonfiction is clever too. It just, you know, it presents itself as...
No, but you said something about a particular scene in the Illuminatus
trilogy.
Oh,
yeah. I said, do you mean the scene in Illuminatus trilogy where the author is presenting a very clever book to a publisher and the publisher doesn't get it?
Yeah. Like, I almost feel like it's the Emperor's New Clothes kind of writing. Like, maybe I'm not smart enough to get it. And probably not, because there are millions of people who get it, or hundreds of thousands at least. But they could all be just be going, man... This is really clever, and they don't want to say in front of their friends who think it's clever. I don't get it.
It's early hipster fiction.
I don't get it, man. Yeah.
I mean, that's a possibility. I mean, there are a lot of people who are into Robert Anton Wilson for the comedy of it, and they don't necessarily get the philosophy behind it because it's not terribly explicit. And I mean, I was even one of those people. When I was reading Robert Anton Wilson as a young man, I was kind of a young socialist, and I saw a lot of that in his writing too. Like you could insert whatever you wanted, but now reading it as a mature middle-aged man or whatever, he's a total anarchist, and he admits it, and he uses that language explicitly. And so I don't understand how I missed it when I read it the first time, you know?
Yeah, and for someone who complains about Earth as much as I do, I don't really like a lot of fiction that takes place in other dimensions or other planets or, you know, basically like most of the stuff I like, unless it's comics or cartoons, most of the stuff I like that's fiction, whether it's movies or television or whatever, takes place, you know, somewhere between like 1920 and like 20 years in the future from now. It has to have, like, for me to really like it, it has to have a pretty small core cast, you know, kind of an ensemble cast of like four or five interesting characters, no magic, no time travel. And, you know, these great, I mean, sci-fi by its definition kind of breaks all that. There is that quote of like advanced technology appears as magic to most people.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about like my dad's 94, you know, if you'd gone back in time to when he was 10 and showed him a cell phone, it would blow his mind.
Touchscreen? I mean,
or even a cell phone without a computer in it would blow his mind, you know, because he grew up on a farm where like the nearest telephone was like, you know, a couple miles away. And it was like the rich people in town had a telephone and that was it. And maybe some offices had them, but yeah.
See, I think the best fiction, if it's going to be sci-fi or fantasy, it is a real world scenario with real world characters and consequences. And there is one magical element. And I think that makes a really good sort of examination of like what happens if this one rule changes in the world, right? And it makes the whole thing a thought experiment. But when the whole world is fantasy and the whole world is fake and I have to learn 100 years of fake history to understand the politics of the book, then I'm like, you're just giving me a homework assignment I'm never going to use in real life.
That was a problem with Star Trek for me. I liked it as a kid on TV, but it was like, you know, you had to learn all the players and their little bit of their languages and their politics and...
Yeah.
Although I have a complaint about a lot of Hollywood movies that have exactly that formula, but in a slightly different way. The premise of a lot of really cheesy Hollywood movies is one thing in the
Tremors.
World is vastly different for one person or for everybody, but usually for one person. And then the rest of the movie is him adapting to it. Like What Women Think, you know, that movie where what's
yeah, the name? That is a good example, you know, of a bad example of what I'm talking
about.
Yeah.
Where like, what if this one guy could read the minds of women? How would he react for 2 hours? Yeah.
Right.
Or, you know, what if you had a TV remote that could stop time?
Oh my God. I saw that movie. That was so bad.
My friend Dave Bach did the sound design on that movie. I mean, he gets paid six digits to, you know, sit around in meetings for 4 hours with Adam Sandler and a couple directors, or a director and a couple producers, going, now what sounds should it make when he presses the buttons on this remote?
Oh, great. Okay. I don't know. I had a lot of problems with the continuity in that movie.
I didn't watch it. But
there are not enough buttons on that remote to do everything that he did.
There's not enough buttons on that remote to do what needs to be done. You know, and a person that really kind of messes with my view of like what I love in fiction and what I don't is Robert Heinlein, because he has a lot of books where, yeah, you know, I mean, a lot of books, the first 10% of them take place in the normal world and then go to this magical world. But in Heinlein books, they often, like, 50% of the book takes place in the normal world, and I love them. And then, like, when it switches to the part where things are not as they seem and there's extra dimensions and magical powers, after about four pages, I just throw the book against the wall. A really good example is Glory Road. I love the first half of that book. That book also has one of the greatest opening sentences of any book I've ever read. It said, I was 21 and couldn't figure out which party to vote against. That's kind of how I've been my whole life until I just gave up on those people.
You know, I think Stranger in a Strange Land is probably one of the best examples of the one I'm talking about, where it's a real-world scenario, and there's this one fantasy element of this boy from Mars who's human, but he was raised on Mars. And so he comes here as a stranger on Earth and doesn't understand what these crazy primates are doing.
I think that must have inspired that horrible movie with David Bowie, Man Who Fell to Earth. It's a very similar kind of idea.
I haven't seen that movie.
Yeah, it's a movie where a man from another planet comes to Earth, and they're coming to Earth because they need to harvest it for its water, because their planet is going extinct with dryness. And he basically, like, falls to the desert in Nevada with a gold watch on, and that's it. And he goes and pawns the watch and ends up building, like, a many billion dollar empire. Basically, he, you know, sells the watch, gets a train ticket to New York City, walks into the office of some patent attorney and says, I have these 27 ideas I'd like to patent. And it's like advanced alien technology from his civilization. And, you know, pretty soon he's the most powerful man in the world. And
I would hope an alien would know better than to visit a patent office.
Well, you know, this movie's written in the 70s, but I don't know, if you wanted to gank a bunch of money so you could steal all the water quick, it might be the way to do it. But yeah, I actually have a really weird experience. I discussed this last night on the show. A really weird experience with Stranger in a Strange Land is I read that book. It was the only book I brought with me while doing a 12-day paid medical research experiment in a government medical research experiment as a guinea pig in the National Institute of Health, which it turned out once I got there and started reading the book is where they take the alien and hold him prisoner.
That is really weird.
I should have left the book there, like, for the next guinea pig. That would have been funny. Like, enjoy. Love, Michael.
Yeah. Especially because it's Michael Valentine Smith.
Oh, right? Yeah, I forgot.
Just wrote Michael.
I forgot. So let's do a little bit more on this who is Satoshi, who shot Mr. Burns, the government section. The government section
so
is great.
So do you think this is plausible? You think it is the government? Does this seem plausible to you?
Read some more of that section and I'll tell you.
Sure. So here's where we kind of left off. It's if governments believed a widely used digital currency was inevitable, Bitcoin could be a preemptive strike against a potentially malevolent iteration. From the U.S. perspective, it could have been created as a hedge against the waning international power of the dollar.
Though, okay, wait, is this a second theory you're going on
no,
to?
No, this
now?
Is in the government section.
No, but in the government section, there's like eight theories. The one I want to address the one about a preemptive strike against a worse Bitcoin.
That's what it's saying.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are you still on that part is what I'm asking.
Yeah.
Okay. Continue. Sorry. Thank you.
Okay. So though given the Fed's policies of quantitative easing, this seems unlikely. The same could be said about the EU and the failing euro. Along these lines, some have pointed to EU directives on digital currencies that were implemented and voted for well before Bitcoin became widely known as a possible clue.
I want to conjecture. I want you to conjecture what that worst Bitcoin, like worse for governments Bitcoin would have looked like that that Bitcoin would have been a preemptive strike against. Would it come?
I mean,
with,
there's not that, a
would,
whole lot you could do to Bitcoin to make it worse for government. You know what would do it though is if the ledger had an expiration date. If instead of having an ongoing ledger from the beginning of Bitcoin to now, it was sort of accepted that the ledger expires after a month and it disappears. So
why?
That there isn't, because then you couldn't do forensics later.
Oh, but the government has probably been tracking a copy of that since about a year into it.
Well, yeah, they have, but I mean, you don't have to track it. Now you can just download the blockchain and view the whole.
Yeah.
And they're going to develop forensic sort of blockchain analyzing technology, and there are people doing this for market reasons too. But I'm saying, like, if the ledger sort of like you throw away your tax paperwork after a couple of years, or at least
seven.
Some people do. Is it 7 years? I don't know.
Seven is generally considered safe because they can generally audit you back 7 years. But that's old information. I'll bet they can audit you 50 years now.
So I'm saying that the blockchain didn't save that old information for them. I think that might be worse. But there's not a lot you could do to Bitcoin to make it worse for government.
I think if the original wallet had been what is promised in Dark Wallet.
Yeah.
I think that'd be worse. I mean, I really like – it's May Day. It's after midnight, and it's today is the launch date. They've been pimping this video for a week now, saying May 1st, 2014, Dark Wallet is here in alpha. Now, alpha is before even beta. It's like, I'm not even going to download this thing. And that's nothing about Cody Wilson. That's just about alpha software. I'm going to let the true believers download it. If I were to use it, I would probably put it on a clean install of a computer with nothing else on it, certainly without any other cryptocurrencies on it. And I would probably transfer a tiny bit of Bitcoin to it and test that without having it on it. You know,
to make sure all the parts move.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be with any alpha thing. That's not anything about Dark Wallet.
Well, we'll see. That's in about 15 minutes. You think they're going to make their deadline?
I don't know. I mean, it's 15 minutes where you live. It's already 12:46 here, and Cody's in Texas, so it's...
So how's it going? How's it work?
Maybe it's been out for a while. Let's check it out. Who knows?
Maybe the dollar died yesterday and nobody told us.
We didn't get the memo yet. Yeah. All right. We'll be back for our... tweak and review, our redemption in the third act, our denouement after this.
You're listening to Michael Dean After Dark, the invigorating alternative to those other late night shows.
Love the Fiends and want to help out? We do take donations and we put them back into our Liberty projects. You can make a donation by clicking on the spinning coin on any post. But what if you want to help, but you ain't got no cash? Or you made a donation and you want to help more? Here's how you can help. Download and seed our torrents to help keep us drone-proof. There's a torrent club link at the top of freedomfiends.com. You can also blog the Fiends and share episode links on Facebook, Twitter, and elsewhere. You can rate and review our movies on Amazon and IMDb. You can rate and review the Freedom Fiends and our songs on iTunes. That really helps a lot. You can buy our movies and share them with friends or give them out as gifts. And one of the best ways to spread liberty is to buy a bunch of Freedom Fiends buttons and give them out as gifts. Wholesale prices are available, and you can also comment on our site, or better yet, comment about us on other sites. And please email the site link to all your friends. Thanks for helping spread the Fiends message worldwide to as many liberty people as you can, especially to those who don't yet get it. You rock.
Yeah. Uh-huh. This is the final installment for this evening of Michael Dean After Dark. And Davi Barker is going to explain to us why some people, Advice Magazine, think that Bitcoin is a government plot. What was the last point they said?
So the last point is that some people are afraid. So there's this sort of fear that predates Bitcoin, that there's a global digital currency coming, and it's kind of this mark of the beast thing that everybody's transactions will be controlled and centralized by some government that whatever. I'm sure there are examples of this in like Freedom to Fascism and documentaries like that. So the fear is that Bitcoin was designed as a kind of Trojan horse to give us what appears like a free currency, but there will be a key turned sometime that turns it into that dangerous mark of the beast digital currency world.
Boy, I would feel really bad if that happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're kind of trying to do that with regulation, but I don't really think that's not the key, because it's people are getting around it left and right. But
well, if there are conspiracies at this level, you got to figure Congress is sort of ignorant to it. So you would expect Congress to be sort of blundering around trying to figure it out just like everyone else.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I said in 1996, I wrote, and this is in my 1999 novel, Starving in the Company of Beautiful Women, which you can find an ebook of on Pirate Bay, or you can order a paperback copy of it on Amazon used. I printed 1,000 copies, and this was before you could go, you know, upload something and get it printed on demand. Like, I actually went to a printer. I spent $4,000 printing 1,000 copies of this book, and it's well bound too. It's a lot more nicely done than on-demand printing, and it's very out of print, but there are used copies of it, and they range in price from like $1.50 to like $150. None of them are average book prices. They're like really cheap or really expensive, which is kind of cool. A lot of the records I've done are like that too. But I said in that book, it was the main character, who's kind of me, just thinking out loud, kind of thinking how clever he is, and he says something like, "Email is just a plot made up by the government to make it easier to read all of our mail without steaming open envelopes." And then I went on to say something, it was very poetic, I can't remember the exact passage, but it was something to the effect of like, who would have thought that Big Brother's boot on our face wouldn't have come as a boot on our face, but rather as something that we all clamored to have installed. And that was like Web 1.0, I was saying that about it. And I didn't really believe that. I believed it was freeing, but I also, in 1996, I was saying, I'm convinced the government's reading everyone's email and tapping everyone's phone. And people thought I was absolutely bonkers and called me a conspiracy theorist. And I've talked to a few people who said that to me, and most of them weren't even on the internet then. And I've talked to a few people who said that then to me since the Edward Snowden revelations. And they're like, they don't back down on it. They're like, yeah,
they still think you're crazy.
They still think I'm crazy. And, or they say that old trope of, well, if you have nothing to hide, you shouldn't care if the government reads your mail. I actually said that one time out loud. I actually believed that at one point in my life. And I said it to my wife before we got married, when we were just dating, and her jaw dropped. And, looking back, I'm like, okay, that's one of the many reasons I can say I married the right woman, because she got there before I did, you know?
That's cool. Yeah, I feel like I never got any acknowledgement from any of the people who said I was crazy about these things.
She read a lot of Heinlein as a teenager, though.
Yeah.
I did not.
I did, too. My mom made well, she didn't make me. She gave me Stranger in a Strange Land when I was, like, 14.
Did she, like, reward you, like, you know? You'll get your allowance.
No, my parents' approach to books was like, read the first 5 pages, and if you're not hooked, throw the book away. And so they would occasionally give me these books, and I read Douglas Adams that way, and I became a lifelong reader that way.
Huh. Well, it's been a great show, man, and I wonder if we're going to wake up tomorrow and find out that governments have collapsed because of Dark Wallet. I hope so.
It's a possibility.
Oh, it's always good to have you on the show, man.
Yeah, good times.
Good times. When are you on again?
Wednesday.
Excellent. Looking forward to it.
I'll see you then.
Yep. We'll stick around. We'll have our post game.
This has been Michael Dean After Dark. I hope we've helped calm the hamster in your brain and left you in a better place than where we found you. We'll be here 5 nights a week, same time and channel. In the meantime, go to michaelwdean.com for more. That's michaelwdean.com. Thank you and have a wonderful evening. Good night.